Okay, so thank you so much, everyone, for being here tonight. I'm really delighted to finally have arrived in this Sangha because I heard so many good things about it. And I can feel the good energy in the room here. You know, one of the benefits of my job, in quotation marks, is that I get to travel around the world and land in different communities and meet really inspiring people. So I've been very well taken care of in the short time that I've been here. So it really is a delight to be here. You might have noticed just a slight trace of a foreign accent. I actually grew up in New Zealand, and in the native Maori culture, when anybody gives a public talk, they start by naming their genealogy, their lineage, literally where they're coming from on different levels, so that the audience knows how to hear them. So just to give you a little bit of my background, and just to check first, can you still hear me okay? Mm-hmm. Great. So I sat my first insight meditation retreat in Thailand in 1999 and completely fell in love with the practice. And from the year 2000, I've been living and working and volunteering in meditation centers and monasteries, sometimes in different parts of the world. And I was fortunate enough to be on staff at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts for 7 years until July 2012. And during that time, I had the opportunity to volunteer in a nearby men's prison. So I ran a weekly sitting group there for a group of between 12 and 15 guys usually every week for about 4 years. And as a result of that experience, I was invited into the IMS and Spirit Rock teacher training program, which is a 4-year program. My mentors for that are Joseph Goldstein and Gil Fronsdal, and I have just under a year to go. We're set to graduate, finish in September this year. So because my visa ran out in July 2012, I have been living out of my suitcase for the last 3.5 years. I basically go wherever I'm invited to teach and to do the teacher trainings. So I travel mostly between Australia, New Zealand, and the US, sometimes a little further afield, Europe, and Britain, Canada. And so I just like to reflect back to you, because sometimes I think when that we do have these powerful communities, one, I know how much work it takes to run them from behind the scenes, and two, sometimes it can be easy to take them for granted. You know, I was recently in Denmark, and my hosts told me that although Denmark is a country of 6 million people, there is one insight meditation teacher in the whole country, and I have a group that meets once a month in the capital city, Copenhagen. So just to put that in context, that what you have here is really special, and it's really a privilege to be here with you all tonight. So this is really the start of our weekend retreat, exploring a set of meditation practices known traditionally as the four Brahma Viharas. And these are specific meditation practices aimed at cultivating kindness or metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity or balance of mind. And I thought before we start exploring these in more detail, I'd just like to get a sense of how many people know anything about these Brahma Vihara practices. Just a show of hands. How many people have actually done some metta practice? How many people have done any of the other Brahma Viharas, compassion, joy, and equanimity? Great, great. How about a retreat involving these? Excellent. That's good, because quite often in this insight tradition, there tends to be more emphasis put on mindfulness than on these Brahma Vihara practices. So I'm really happy to see that there's a whole range of experience here. So I'd like to give a little bit of context about how these practices fit into our mindfulness practice, our insight meditation. And as some of you probably know, in the Buddhist teachings as a whole, there's a really strong emphasis on what's known as the middle way. And after the Buddha attained what's known as Nibbana, or awakening, in the very first teaching that he gave, he explained this middle way as not falling into the habit of self-indulgence on one hand, or into self-mortification on the other. So we have these two extremes that we can fall into. Self-indulgence is that tendency to take refuge in sense pleasures. So we often put a lot of effort into chasing after pleasant experiences and trying to manipulate the world out there to give us some kind of happiness. But as I'm sure most of you know from your own experience, usually at best that's only partly successful or temporarily successful. And the downside is that it makes us really dependent on things out there being a certain way in order for us to be happy. And so then on the other side of the tendency is the opposite of self-indulgence, is traditionally known as self-mortification. And in the Buddhist teachings on the middle way, this originally referred to some spiritual practices that were common in his time that involved different ways of subduing the body. There was a sense that the body was impure and had to be subdued. So there were practices that involved things like sleeping on a bed of nails, which still exists in India today, or standing on one leg, or never sitting down, or severely restricting how much food one ate. Fortunately for us, those are not parts of our practices here today. But one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, he made the point that this kind of torturing the body isn't so common. But what we do have today is a kind of a psychological self-torture. This seems to be more and more something in our conditioning where we can be incredibly hard on ourselves. We have tendencies towards feelings of inadequacy or unworthiness or even outright self-loathing that perhaps weren't as common in the Buddha's day. So this idea of the middle way is really paying attention to and cultivating skillful states of heart and mind in the service of finding this balance, this middle way. And there's a metaphor in the Buddha's teachings which I found very helpful in my own practice. It's the metaphor of what's known as the two wings to awakening, wisdom on one side and compassion on the other. And from that metaphor, you can see straight away that if we're going to fly metaphorically, we need to have this balance between wisdom and compassion. I'm going to be going into more detail about them in a few minutes, but just as a kind of a working definition, by wisdom, in this context, it's another word for insight, for the clear seeing, for really understanding the deepest truths of our human experience. And compassion refers to the capacity to turn towards what's difficult, to turn to and meet our own and other people's challenges with kindness and courage. So in the bigger picture of our practice, it can be helpful from time to time just to perhaps do a review and see how is this balance between wisdom and compassion. Because in my own practice, I can recognize with the benefit of hindsight sometimes where one or other of these wings got a little more developed ahead of the others. And those phases can be quite uncomfortable and unsettling and even discouraging, until we realize what has happened, and then we can take the necessary steps to come back to balance. And I think perhaps because we're in the insight tradition, it seems to be more common for the wisdom wing to get further ahead than the compassion wing. So for example, on the psychological level, when we start to pay attention to our habits of personality, our default conditioning, we can start to see our neuroses in the full technicolor or extra high definition, and it can be painful. Because there's an old joke that, you know, self-knowledge is not necessarily good news. And sometimes we really can come into contact with that in a very immediate and painful way. And so we need to have some compassion to be able to soften and absorb those understandings. And then on another level, when we start to see more clearly into the three universal characteristics, the fact that everything is constantly changing, because it's changing, we can't find lasting satisfactoriness, and that nothing really comes back to a fixed and unchanging me to whom all this experience is happening. Those truths can be unsettling. So again, we might need to consciously cultivate compassion as a way to develop a more resilient heart and mind that can navigate these challenges with some degree of balance. So that's how sometimes wisdom gets ahead of compassion. And on the other hand, sometimes compassion gets ahead of the wisdom. So we might start to connect really deeply with the truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, and pain and existential suffering. And we can start to connect with that so deeply that we can get overwhelmed. So then we might need to consciously come back to the wisdom practice, and again to notice, to tune into the fact that everything is impermanent. Then it becomes possible to taste moments of deep freedom, even in the midst of difficulty. So bringing awareness to these two wings of the practice of wisdom and compassion, and learning how to balance them, is really part of the art of this whole insight practice. You could also think of them very broadly as being the head and the heart practice. So wisdom is the head and compassion is the heart. And because Western culture, I think, tends to be more head-centric, if that's a word, the wisdom practices have tended to be more popular so far than the heart practices. And because of that bias, most of us could probably benefit from consciously turning more to the heart practices, which is exactly what we're going to be doing this weekend. So hopefully you can join us for that. So I'd like to take a few moments just to give a bit of an overview of what these four Brahma-Vihara practices are and how they work together to support this freedom of heart and mind, which is really the goal of all Buddhist meditation practices. Bless you. So this phrase, Brahma-Vihara, is a strange one, and it's difficult to translate into English because we don't really have an equivalent of Brahma. In the Buddha's time, I understand he was a kind of god in the Brahmin religion or tradition, the highest god. And the word Vihara means a dwelling place or a residence or an abode. These are all old-fashioned words for home, somewhere where we can rest. So the term Brahma-Vihara we sometimes translate as heavenly abodes or divine abidings or sublime states, sometimes the four immeasurables, because of the boundlessness of these states. Ultimately, we can practice these qualities so that we extend them infinitely to all beings, unconditionally. So in this sense, they are without boundaries or boundless. And I wanted to highlight this aspect of the Brahma-Vihara practices because in the way they're taught today, there's a slightly different emphasis. As those of you who've done some metta practice before will know, the traditional way of doing it is that we recite phrases of well-wishing to categories of beings, ourselves, a benefactor, a good friend, the so-called difficult person, and then to all beings everywhere. That's the traditional way that we seem to have inherited doing this practice. But in the Buddha's lifetime, in the teachings that come from his lifetime, the instructions were just to simply dwell with a heart filled with the energy of kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity, and then radiate that energy outwards through the four compass directions, so north and south and east and west, and then above and below and all around until it pervades the entire world. So I'd like to read you the actual words from the sutta in relation to this first Brahma-Vihara of metta, but it includes, we can do the same pattern for the other three. So it says, here, practitioners, of a dwells pervading one direction with his or her heart filled with goodwill. Likewise, the second, the third, and the fourth direction, so above, below, and around, he or she dwells pervading the entire world, everywhere and equally, with his or her heart filled with goodwill, abundant, grown great, measureless, free from enmity and free from distress. So we're invited to radiate these wholesome energies in each of the four directions, pervading the entire world, and of course that includes we ourselves too. And the benefits come back to us also, because you may have heard at the end of that passage, we experience freedom from enmity and freedom from distress. And these two types of freedom, when they're developed to their highest potential, become the freedom of nibbana, of full awakening. So several teachers these days really say that the Brahma-Vihara practices are equal to insight or wisdom practice in this capacity to lead all the way to full liberation. So perhaps some of us are not quite at that point yet. I know I myself aren't. So in the meantime, we can use these trainings as very powerful relief for those times when the mind has contracted around some kind of negative mind state or another. And the Buddha did actually recommend that we do this. There's another passage that I'd like to read you where he says, cultivate the meditation on goodwill. For by cultivating the meditation on goodwill, ill will disappears. Cultivate the meditation on compassion, for by cultivating the meditation on compassion, cruelty disappears. Cultivate the meditation on joy, for by cultivating the meditation on joy, listlessness disappears. Cultivate the meditation on equanimity, for by cultivating the meditation on equanimity, anger disappears. So I know some of you are familiar with some of the discourses, the suttas, and you might know that they're usually fairly low-key. But in this passage, there are actual exclamation marks, exclamation points. It says, cultivate the meditation on equanimity, cultivation. So the Buddha is very emphatic that we can work all four of these practices together as antidotes to the types of negativity that sometimes take over the mind. And in my own practice, I've found it helpful to think of these four as really being different facets of a liberated heart and mind. I was on retreat at the Forest Refuge in Barre, Massachusetts a few years ago, and in one of his talks, Joseph shared a quote from the 19th century Tibetan master, Shabkar, where he's describing the ultimate nature of mind. He described it as, the mind nature is vivid as a flawless piece of crystal, intrinsically empty, naturally radiant, ceaselessly responsive. And that phrase really struck me, perhaps because I was practicing the Brahma-Viharas at the time, but this intrinsically empty, naturally radiant, ceaselessly responsive. And perhaps because of the reference to crystal, I thought of a diamond, and how the diamond's purity allows it to very naturally respond to light. So sometimes it flashes red, sometimes blue, or sometimes yellow, just depending on the light conditions. In the same way, when our hearts and minds are really pure, they naturally respond with kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity. And as I was exploring these different Brahma-Vihara colours, I saw how they all can be used to sort of balance each other out. Now, often on retreats, we give the most attention to metta as the foundation of these practices, and there often isn't time to go further into the compassion and the joy and the equanimity. But I've seen in my own life and with some of the students I work with that sometimes metta is not actually the most appropriate response to a situation. So sometimes people will say things like, well, I've been trying to practice metta for my ex-partner that I'm in a 5-year custody battle with, and it's just not working. So, well, have you thought of perhaps compassion or self-compassion? And usually they look at me almost with horror because that had never occurred to them. So I'll be coming back to self-compassion in just a minute, but before I go there, I wanted to just extend this analogy of the diamond a little bit further because I think it can help explain how these four practices are interrelated. So if you think of the shape of a diamond, this kind of four-pointed image, you can think of metta as being at the bottom point of the diamond because it is the foundation. So we have this foundation of goodwill, of kindness, friendliness, benevolence. And it's said that when this kindness turns towards what's difficult in life, turns towards dukkha or unsatisfactoriness, it naturally manifests as compassion. So you can think of compassion as being on one of the side points of the diamond. And then in the same way, when this foundation of kindness turns towards what's going well, when it turns towards happiness and good fortune, it flowers as joy. Appreciative joy or mudita. So we have compassion and joy on the two side points of the diamond. And then when compassion and joy are completely in balance, you can think of them as converging at the top of the diamond as equanimity, this balance of heart and mind that doesn't fall into grief at the 10,000 sorrows or into elation at the 10,000 joys, but stays perfectly balanced. So this is just one way of thinking of these practices. You could also flip them, have equanimity at the bottom and metta at the top. We can dance with them in all different ways, but hopefully that gives you a sense of how they might balance each other out. Because as I've been saying, this theme of balance is really woven through the Buddha's teachings, and we can use the way these four practices relate to each other to balance them out too. So sometimes if the metta is feeling a little bit dry or superficial, we might change the compassion practice for a while to juice it up and give it some meat. When we can tune into suffering with an attitude of kindness, it can really strengthen our sense of purpose and bring more depth to the metta. On the other hand, there may be times when we're doing compassion practice and we start to feel bogged down by all of the suffering, falling into grief perhaps. So then we might consciously turn to mudita practice, to joy, and notice what is going well for myself or this other person. What are some things I can feel grateful for or appreciate, even in the midst of these challenges? We can usually find some things that are going okay or even well. Sometimes, though, mudita, we can get a little bit exuberant or giddy or a little bit ungrounded with it, and so then we might want to either switch back to compassion or perhaps consciously cultivate equanimity to more deliberately find that balance that isn't falling to either grief or exuberance. So that's just a brief overview of how all of these four can work together. I'd like to come back briefly to each one of them in a little more detail. And if this seems a lot, don't worry, we'll be going through over these over the course of the weekend. So don't feel like you have to sort of absorb all of this right now. But coming back to the first practice, the practice of metta, as I said, this is the one that often gets the most airplay, and it's often presented as kind of shorthand for all the other three. But we really do need the other three for our practice to be strong. I think of it as like a piece of rope, you know, a really strong rope is woven together strands, a four-ply rope or four strands of rope woven together is much stronger than a single strand. And in the same way, when we weave these four practices together, we can get real strength and depth. So metta is the foundation, and it's a Pali word. Pali is the word, the language that the Buddha's teachings were transmitted in. And it's usually been translated into English as loving kindness. But these days, many translators are actually leaving out the loving part, because in English, the word love has a huge range of different connotations. So we can talk about loving ice cream, for example, at one end. And at the other end, we have the whole sort of inflation of romantic love that's in lots of B-grade movies and cheesy pop songs and music videos, this kind of love that's very exclusive and passionate, and it's only for one person, and it's very emotional and usually pretty unstable. It doesn't last. So in many ways, this kind of love is the exact opposite of the unconditional love of metta. So I prefer to translate metta as just simple kindness and leave out the loving part altogether, partly also because it makes it more accessible. I sometimes refer to myself as a metta skeptic, because when I started this practice, I found it almost unbearable. And so here I am teaching metta retreats. It's kind of ironic. But if you think of metta as just simple kindness, then hopefully that makes it easier to begin to generate. And in some suttas, they even talk about metta as the absence of ill will. So that's pretty good, right? Just the absence of ill will is good enough. So metta, we start with the foundation of it, and then when we can turn that foundation of metta to what's difficult, that becomes karuna or compassion. The English word compassion literally means feeling with, and it's sometimes described as the heart that vibrates in response to another's pain or to our own pain. And for many people, this too is a stretch, because perhaps consciously or unconsciously, we may have come to a spiritual practice to get away from suffering. Wait a minute. Didn't I come here to get beyond suffering? So why would I want to turn into it? It hurts. So we can have this counterintuitive sense of it. The one analogy that might be helpful is if you're driving on a wet or icy road and the car starts to skid out, the driving experts tell us that we need to steer into the skid to come out of it more quickly. All of our reactions are to turn the wheel in the opposite direction, but that usually ends up spinning us into a ditch or worse. So we have to have the presence of mind to steer into the skid, and we come out of it in better shape. Or perhaps it's like, I don't know if you swim here, maybe it's not warm enough. But I grew up by a surfing beach. I didn't surf, but I used to just play in the waves and do a little bit of body surfing. If you're out there and one of those big waves starts coming, again, the instinct is to turn and try and swim for it, or if you can touch the ground, run. Usually you get slammed. But if you can turn to the wave and dive just before it hits you, it's pretty turbulent for a while, but you do come out the other side in better shape. So having this capacity to turn towards suffering, it's not some form of masochism. If it's done appropriately, if we find ourselves falling into grief or despair or getting dumped, then we might have missed the mark. So one of my monastic teachers, Venerable Analio, he talks about compassion not so much in terms of connecting with sorrow, but connecting with the capacity to be free of sorrow. So again, if we find ourselves lost in overwhelm, we might need to focus more on the capacity to be relieved from suffering than the suffering itself. So that can be a refinement of the practice. And it also leads us more into this third Brahmavihara, the Brahmavihara of mudita, or joy. And that's the capacity to turn metta, kindness, towards what's going well, towards good fortune. And traditionally this was talked about as joy at another's good fortune. So it's often translated as sympathetic joy or appreciative joy or altruistic joy. And traditionally the instructions were that you do it for other people and not for yourself, which I thought was odd because everywhere else in the Buddha's teachings we're told include everyone, make no distinction between yourself and others. So I did a bit of research and found out that the word mudita simply means gladness. And there is no sense originally that it has to be for someone else. So I like to include myself and in the mudita practice as well as others, and we'll experiment with that a little bit on Sunday. And again, you know, this mudita might seem counterintuitive because it's not generally part of our culture to feel joy in response to someone else's good fortune. Often there's at least a little tinge of envy or resentment. But some of you may know the Dalai Lama's famous statement that if we're able to connect with somebody else's happiness as much as our own, then our odds of being happy increase 7 billion to 1. 7 billion is approximately the current world population. So mudita can play a very important role in uplifting the mind at those times when we might be feeling overwhelmed by the suffering of the world. So we might, if our wisdom factor is weak and we're have sunk into a little bit of grief, then we might need to consciously change to mudita practice and notice what's going well, what can I appreciate. And then on the other hand, sometimes the mudita practice can get a little too kind of almost giddy or ungrounded. So again, we might need to come back to the other wing of compassion to balance it out. I'd like to read you something that Sharon Salzberg wrote about this. She's done a lot of exploration of these practices. And she talks about the relationship between compassion and sympathetic joy. She says, compassion balances sympathetic joy and keeps it from degenerating into sentimentality or ignorant optimism. Mudita keeps compassion from degenerating into brooding over the enormous breadth and depth and duration of suffering in the world. Compassion guards mudita, and mudita guards compassion. Together, in their complementary ways, the two keep us from building barriers behind which we confine ourselves to experiencing only a narrow segment of life. So you get the sense of this opening up potential to become boundless. And finally, we come to the fourth Brahmavihara, which is at the top of the diamond. This is the Brahmavihara of equanimity, which is an old-fashioned word meaning evenness of mind or of heart-mind. I'll sometimes use the phrase heart-mind because I understand that in Asian languages there's less of a split between head and heart than our Western culture. So in Asian languages the word mind encompasses emotions and the heart, and it's also more embodied. So when I say heart-mind, I really mean emotions, moods, mind states, and the body. So this, when compassion and joy are perfectly balanced, we get this natural equanimity where we're not pulled into attachment to what's pleasant, we're not repelled by what's unpleasant, nor do we zone out in relation to what's neutral. But these days, equanimity is not a word in common use. I mean, even saying it gives my mouth a workout. It's not something that you hear very often. You know, I don't think I've ever heard someone say, wow, I had so much equanimity when my son backed over the mailbox in our new car. So I love listening to Donald Trump's speeches because it gives my equanimity practice a great workout. It's not something that's really in common parlance. Being hyperactive or hyperreactive is more the norm. And sometimes people who aren't reacting to everything around them are looked on with sort of pity or even suspicion. And I do want to make the point that equanimity is an evenness of mind, but it's not a blank indifference. It's actually a very refined state of awareness that can clearly see what's happening but doesn't react out of our usual unconscious habit patterns. So to be able to respond with wisdom and compassion, we need to see things clearly and kindly. And the word upekkha has a lot to do with vision, of seeing. It literally means to look over, which suggests being in a position to see the bigger picture. So one analogy I think of is if you've had the experience of climbing up a mountainside, getting to a point perhaps above the tree line where you get a clear vantage point, and suddenly you can see where you came from in a whole new context. There's an openness and an expansiveness, and I'm not just stuck in my own narrow viewpoint anymore. And that change of perspective can really feel like a moment of freedom. So as we start to get more familiar with this true equanimity, we start to feel the benefits of cultivating this balanced state. Our whole nervous system gets a rest from being overstimulated. And it's actually more pleasant and more sustainable than the agitated energy of ordinary happiness that comes from sense pleasure. Because after all, how many bowls of ice cream can you eat before you get sick? Not many sense pleasures are really very sustainable in the long term. So that's a brief summary of the key qualities of the four Brahma Vihara practices. And although they're taught separately, in practice, when we start to engage with them, they tend to naturally flow into each other. So for example, you might start to practice metta for a good friend and find that compassion just naturally arises when you remember her recent health challenge. Or perhaps joy comes up when you hear about her new relationship or birth of a new grandchild. And there might be other times when equanimity comes up, when you recognize that perhaps you can't solve your friend's problems for them, but you can be a good listener. So in this way, we're just constantly responding to conditions with this natural and appropriate response. We're developing a kind of emotional literacy where we learn to recognize what in the beginning might be quite new and unfamiliar states of mind. And then we can just start to flow or to reflect as in the diamond analogy. There's another analogy that I found quite helpful from the Zen teacher Charlotte Joko Beck. Some of you might know her. Where she's describing how the Brahma Vihara states can soften us and to undo this tendency to contract around what's unpleasant and to grasp at what's pleasant. She says, if we don't have any awareness of how we're relating to ourselves and the world, she says we're like frozen ice cubes. She says, to protect ourselves, we freeze as hard as we can and hope that when we collide with others, they will shatter before we do. We freeze because we're afraid. Our fear makes us rigid, fixed, and hard, and we create mayhem as we bump into others. Any obstacle or unexpected difficulty is likely to shatter us. Ice cubes hurt. Ice cubes have a hard time. When we're hard and rigid, no matter how careful we are, we tend to slip and slide out of control. We have sharp edges that do damage and we hurt not only others, but ourselves too. A lucky few, however, may meet an ice cube that has actually melted and become a puddle. what happens if an ice cube meets a puddle. The warmer water in the puddle begins to melt the ice cube. The ice cube begins to realize it doesn't have to be hard, rigid, and cold. There is another way to be in the world. The fire of attention begins to melt its hardness. So I love this description of the fire of attention, which I think of as mindfulness, which helps us to become mushy. And I think of the Brahma Viharas as really as a catalyst for this practice of becoming mushy. There's the warmth of goodwill and of compassion, of joy and equanimity that accelerates this dissolving the boundaries between self and other, so we can end up in the boundless states that the term Brahma Vihara is really pointing to. For most of us, though, this process of warming and softening doesn't happen overnight. And this was definitely true for me when I first started to try these practices. As I said, I was a metta skeptic because I would sit down to cultivate what I thought was supposed to be oceanic bliss states of overwhelming love, and I would come face to face with irritation and resentment and boredom and envy and disconnection and anger and judgment and self-judgment and numbness and disdain and pity, and you know, I could go on and on, but I don't want to keep you too much longer. Very long list of things that were not metta. So I learned the hard way why these Brahma Vihara practices are euphemistically known as purification practices. That really means they're designed to show you all of your shadows. And if non-metta comes up, this doesn't actually mean that the practice isn't working. Doesn't mean that we're doing something wrong. It actually means that the practices are doing exactly what they're designed to do, to show us all the obstacles that get in the way of the kindness or the compassion or the joy or the equanimity. Because if we don't see them, how can we do anything about them? Still, I think this is one reason why a lot of people struggle with these practices or avoid them altogether. And because, as I said earlier, you know, many of us have this strongly conditioned tendency to be really hard on ourselves, and self-hatred in various forms is often a big part of our social conditioning. So perhaps because of this, in the field of psychology, as probably many of you know, the field of self-compassion is a burgeoning new area of interest and research. And I will be touching more into this in the weekend, but I just wanted to share a little bit from a psychologist who's working in this field, describing the intense challenges that many of us face when we try to turn towards kindness and compassion. He says, commonly, for high shame and self-critical people, particularly those from harsh backgrounds, the beginning of the experience of warmth and kindness can ignite considerable sadness and grief. Self-kindness can be viewed with suspicion as being soft, self-indulgent, or not deserved. This usually indicates a fear of developing or experiencing self-compassion. Exploration might reveal that the individual is afraid that if they give up self-criticism, they will become lazy, unpleasant, or unlikable. Something that they will be punished for self-compassion by paying for it later or having it taken away altogether. So because of that painful conditioning, it's often totally counterproductive to try to force ourselves to feel some kind of positive emotion. And so for me, one of the ways I had to come into this was to think of the Brahma Viharas more as a practice of listening rather than making emotions. And I borrowed the metaphor of the Hubble telescope. I'm not a scientist, but my limited understanding is that the Hubble telescope is this incredibly powerful machinery, piece of machinery that's scanning the deepest, darkest recesses of the universe, looking for the faintest signs of life. And in the beginning, my Brahma Vihara practice felt like that. It was like turning the Hubble telescope into the deepest, darkest recesses of my heart and looking for the faintest flicker of life. But once we see it and recognize it, we can help to amplify that signal, cultivate it, and allow it to grow. So the good news that I'm pointing to in all this is that we can change. It's possible to change, and we know that, confirmed by neuroscience research, that the brain does have this capacity to change. It's known as neuroplasticity. We can change the emotional set point of our hearts and minds and move it into a more positive direction. Which really is confirming what the Buddha knew many centuries ago. In the Dvaidavitaka Sutta, he says, "Meditators, whatever a meditator frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his or her mind." So if we think and ponder upon negative mind states, we're strengthening the neurons that fire together, wire together, or making those channels stronger. The opposite is also true, that if we train the heart and mind in the direction of compassion and joy and kindness and equanimity, we're strengthening those pathways. And they have done many fMRI studies of people who, like Tibetan monks who spent lifetimes practicing compassion, and some of those guys apparently they had to recalibrate the machines because they were off the charts of what the scientists thought was humanly possible. So I find that inspiring, that we can strengthen these pathways. And even though I've been exploring these practices for quite a few years now, I'm still in awe of their transformative power. I've seen it in myself and in many of my students, the incredible breakthroughs that people can make after lifetimes of really difficult mind states, heart-mind states. So that's probably plenty of talking about them for now. I thought to offer a short guide in meditation, but first just wanted to really thank you for your kind attention and invite us to have maybe a 5-minute stretch break. So thank you. I'll ring the bell in 5 or so minutes.